Hello, I'm Dan Masterson, host of Strategy Talk, where we take a unique view of world events. We report news as history. With me today is the editor of StrategyPage.com and well-known military author, Jim Dunnigan. Associate editor and syndicated columnist, Austin Bay, also joins us.
Austin and Jim, welcome this morning. Things are still going bad in Syria. Kofi Annan has tried to negotiate some sort of ceasefire, but it doesn't seem to be working, and the Syrian government doesn't seem to be cooperating. Where are things headed over there, Jim?
Well, it appears that the Assad family, is carrying on like they were in, the Game of Thrones, where you win or you die. They are in a situation very similar to that, because in the last 20 years, it's become difficult for a dictator to quietly retire. And this has been generally a bad thing, because Sun Tzu pointed out thousands of years ago that never face an opponent that you don't leave a way out for. In other words, somebody that's cornered is going to put up a much stronger fight, even if they're going to eventually lose. And this is the problem with Syria. Now, they do technically have a way out. I mean, they could fly off to exile in Iran, possibly Russia or China or North Korea if they're really desperate. But they would lose all their power. And that's the biggest drug going in that part of the world. And people do not want to go cold turkey on power. So they're digging in. Now, their Iranian advisors are telling them, look, your situation is similar to ours. Most Iranians hate us, the religious dictatorship that runs Iran. But God bless those Russians. They invented the perfect police state. Well, it's not 100% perfect, as we found out in 1989. But these time-pressed techniques can keep you in power for a long, long time. And it's a combination of lying and killing. Lie to the UN, kill as many Syrians as you have to in order to get the others to basically get on their knees. And this is exactly what they're doing. They show no indication of trying to reach a settlement, as it were, with the rebels. Because the rebels, basically, are a Sunni minority being ruled by a Shia. The Sunni majority is being ruled by a Shia minority. Actually, it's not even really Shia. They're heretics, even by Shia standards, but that's another story. The minority has stayed in power for so long, partly with the stick, but also with the carrot. In other words, goodies were dispersed to the leaders of the various communities, the Sunni communities and what have you. But the trouble with a dictatorship is that if it takes too much control of the economy, as they have done in Syria, you slowly but surely run the economy into the ground. And since Syria hasn't got a lot of oil or any other, ready wealth, they've impoverished the nation. And basically, there's no more to steal. So they're at the end of their tether, but they don't want to go. And they're willing to keep killing in order to stay in power in this threadbare, tyranny. And that's the situation right now, and nobody's got an easy way out because there isn't an easy way out.
Austin?
I agree with Jim down the line on the his reading of the Assads. I'll add a few other elements that I believe are strong evidence are in play. We've discussed this before on Strategy Talk, and there are numerous articles, both in the some on-point columns I've done on this, but many of the reports that Jim authored about Syria over the last year, the ties to Iran, which Jim mentioned, are extremely important to the Iranians. And that's why, in one way to frame the struggle, I mean, this is the interior struggle, which is the central story between the very fragmented opposition. Now, we've discussed that in the past as well. I mean, Syria is a demographic super pizza pie, just like Bosnia, with religious groups, ethnic groups, and then some ethnic groups that are divided over the same ethnic group, but they're in clans, and they have deep historical animosities that separate them, and other competitive competition for resources, competition for power, and the like. But the external story is that you've got Iran in a shadow war with NATO. And in another way to frame it, there's an element of truth to this as well. You see China and Russia uniting with Iran and the Assads. Russia's had a client relationship with the Syrian regime for decades, but the common thread there is they're all dictatorships of different stripes, from less absolute, more absolute, and they've seen enough of the Arab Spring toppling dictators. They've seen wobbly dictators in other parts of the world that have fallen or are on their deathbeds. I'm referring here to Zimbabwe with Robert Mugabe and potentially Hugo Chavez in Venezuela, and they've got an investment in fear themselves in the way they run their country. And you see the strongmen fall. That's a threat to them in this increasingly digitally information-connected world. It encourages their dissidents. So it's part of the Russia's commitment to the Syrian government is not absolute, but you can see Putin's and his oligarchs' interest in making sure that the Arab Spring revolts stop somewhere, and that fear and intimidation is shown, and repression are shown to work. That's part of what the Iranians are engaged in, as Jim said. Those factors are, that is why you have the diplomatic assistance from China and Russia and the monetary assistance, security advisors, and weapons from Iran, and to some degree the weapons and other assistance that comes from Russia, because this is the fire break in the 2011 storm of toppling Gaddafi's and toppling other Arab strongmen. This is a marker out there for the dictators, tyrants, and oligarchs. So Assad has some reason to believe that he can succeed in staying in power and stopping and repressing the rebellion. Other component of why he thinks he can do it is, to some degree, the Assads have done this before, primarily putting down Sunni rebels. Hafez al-Assad, Bashir's father, did that several times, most notably in the early 80s with strikes on rebels, Hamas, both in Hama and the 80s. Other smaller outbreaks too, put down by the Assad regime. They've had that success in the past. Plus, they look at how fragmented the country is and how they dominate the security apparatus. And as long as they've got money to continue to pay off the regime maintenance units, or if they lose some of those, we've reported this several times over the last, I want to say, 5-6 months, the number of defections from Syrian government officials and the Syrian army has, there's been a steady stream of defectors. So Assad gets help from Iran with the appearance of Lebanese Hezbollah guerrillas to provide some muscle in the for the security forces if he doesn't trust some of the security forces, but he trusts them, and he's got the money to pay them. So he sees why should I capitulate? Negotiations, in my view, Dan, are simply an attempt to buy time to continue to repress and kill. And I just don't see Assad buying off on, really on Kofi Annan's peace plan, because Annan's peace plan has six important planks in it. Three of them are really repetitions of the Arab League's various peace plans that were generated in August, September of 2011, and then their official one in, as I recall, that was November of 2011, and that calls for a national dialogue. That calls for an end to the violence. Now, one of the planks that Annan has in his plan is to release the political prisoners. Well, Assad's not about to do that for the reasons that Jim outlined in his initial analysis. I mean, he's got to keep the lid on. And if he has a national dialogue, the Alawites minority that rules the country, they're going to be swamped. They've got a lot of enemies. They may be fragmented. Some of the opponents may jostle with one another and ultimately be opposed to each other, but right now they're all focused on the Assads, the Assad clan, and the Alawites that have misruled Syria for decades. And that's where they're going to fight.
Now, one of the things, Jim, that Austin mentioned in his article on Strategy Page this week is that the money drying up from Iran because of the economic pressure being put on Iran with the sanctions and like that is probably going to hurt Assad. Do you see the same thing happening?
Oh, definitely. The Syrian economy is in much worse shape than the Iranians, because even without oil, Iran has a more vibrant, you know, energetic economy than Syria does. I mean, they are both, neither country is a basket case economically, but Iran was always stronger, and the oil only made it stronger. Would have made it much stronger if the senior clerks hadn't been in charge, you know, for the last 30 or so years. But that's another problem many Iranians hope to eventually solve. But the sanctions are much more damaging to Iran, and this will force the Iranians to withdraw their subsidies, a billion or so dollars a month, you know, to the Syrians, just to keep the economy afloat. Once Assad cannot pay his followers, they're going to look for other options, because the Saudis are standing by, you know, ready to buy anybody who's for sale. And this may come down to not who has the bigger battalion, but who has the bigger bank account. Because a lot of the people in Syria are basically fighting for economic freedom. You know, democracy's fine, but you got to eat. You got a family to support. You know, the usual story. Democracy is a good way to hang on to that and to make it continue, but the immediate goal is basically to survive. And the Saudis and the other Gulf states have told, you know, the Syrians, you know, get rid of the Assad, get rid of the Iranian connection, because there's this huge war going on between the Sunni Arabs led by Saudi Arabia and the Shias led by Iran, which the Saudis are, I think, more intent on winning, because for thousands of years the Iranians, long before they were Muslims of any flavor, were top dog in the neighborhood, in that region. And the Iranians are basically the favored team, because they have been winning for a long time. And the Iranians feel now, because A, they have the United States and the West behind them, they have all this oil wealth, which they've kind of squandered like so many other countries, but they have built up big armed forces and they have big time allies. Now is their chance to finally put the Iranians in their place. This does not get played up much in the West, but it's a big deal, especially, you know, among, you know, Sunnis, but especially among the Sunnis of Arabia. And the Syria is caught in between all this. Right now the smart money is shifting, you know, to the Arabs, the Sunnis. because there's so much pressure on Iran, and the money to Syria is drying up, and that may be the key factor, as Austin points out. the key battle in the war for control of Syria may have already been fought, within the banking system.
Austin, how is Turkey looking at everything that's happening in Syria?
Oh, that's so complicated. I'll tell you what. I got asked this question, for what it's worth, or it was discussed yesterday in a class I teach at the University of Texas, the strategy and strategic theory class, about what is Turkey's role. And, of course, the problem is how much time do you have to analyze it? Turkey's obviously has real interests in Syria. Syria shares a border with Turkey. We can start too with the fact that Syrian Kurds have played a major role in the radical elements of the Syrian Kurds and the Kurdistan Workers Party, the PKK, which has been waging a war in Turkey for really since the early 1980s, approaching 30 years. They have, I think the evidence is very solid, that the Assads have used the Kurdish war as a policy tool against Turkey in the past. That was supposedly settled when Turkey in 1998, I think it was, threatened to attack Syria, because Syria was allowing the head of the PKK, Apo Öcalan, to party and live and thrive in downtown Damascus. And so the Turks rolled at least a corps, maybe a couple of corps of their army right up to the border and said, "We're coming." And the next thing, of course, Öcalan is handed over to Turkish intelligence and security police. I believe it was in Nairobi that happened, at the Greek embassy. What an interesting series of connections. Next thing, Apo Öcalan is no longer in Damascus, but he's in the Greek embassy in Nairobi being handed over to the Turks. Anyway, they came out with an agreement that is actually rather important to the current situation in Syria, vis-a-vis Turkey, and that was the Adana Agreement that is 1998, and basically both countries, it's this demonstrably favors Turkey, guaranteed that they would do things to destabilize the other country. Now, how are there destabilizing activities going on from Syria to Turkey? Syrian Kurds still operate with the PKK. We've had numerous reports that the PKK inside Syria is actually, this is from Syrian Kurds, is acting as an ally of the Assads, which doesn't surprise me because I think the Assads have given them money over the years. And have even, there's one story out there, and Dan, there's no way to prove this, but it's cropped up on the internet. It showed up in some wire service reports with a caveat that we can't independently verify it. But some Syrian Kurds say that the PKK has assassinated the Kurdish opponents of the Assads. In other words, it's serving as a secret police, as a terror force for the Assads. Could be propaganda, could be true, but it's an example of turmoil within Syria, the complexity within Syria, but also the way Turkey sees the destabilization threat of the Assads using the Kurdish, the ethnic Kurds as a instrument destabilize, threaten Turkey. We've also seen from other PKK, including, you know, the Iraqi or Turkish PKK, components saying that they would launch attacks inside Turkey if Turkey moves to establish a buffer zone to protect Syrian civilians that extends into Syria. So the reason I'm mentioning this is that this is clearly clearly, or at least Turkey could make the political and diplomatic case that this is a violation of the Adana Agreement, as well as, get this, the flow of refugees themselves. Right now, there's somewhere between 25 and 30,000 Syrian refugees in Turkey. The Turks have been putting up a series of refugee camps, primarily in Antalya and I want to say it Urfa. There's the other, what's the name, Sulla Urfa, but it's a Urfa province. But they could extend right on to Cernak and Mardin, which are also have shared borders with Syria and Syrian Kurd territory. But they're building, Turks are building a rather sophisticated migrant camps, refugee camps. There are reports that the Syrian, the Turkish Red Crescent, which is the International Red Cross in Turkey, believes that within the next few weeks they're going to have 50,000 refugees. And this sounds like it could be over the top, but when you think about it, it may be something that you have to plan for. There are some Red Crescent people in Turkey that say if it gets worse we have we could face 500,000 Syrian refugees in Turkey, which seems to be the preferred destination for many of the Syrians who are fleeing the violence in the regime. Does that constitute a violation of the Adana Agreement? Because it's not only destabilizing, it's expensive, and it's being thrust. The taking care of the refugees is either going to international aid agencies, but it's primarily being paid for by Turkey. My guess would be that somewhere other NATO nations would help them. But that's a violation of the Adana Agreement. And part of the Adana Agreement is it's got an enforcement capability, which is to go back to what the Turks did to try to shake the Assads up when they wanted Apo Achillon, which is, guess what? We have the ability that we have a treaty violation that gives us the authority, should we exercise it, to act. Now, I've gone through all this in detail, but Dan, this is one strand of analysis that I've seen in several Turkish papers, primarily Zaman, but it's mentioned in other English language editions of the Turkish papers, and it reflects, what it does is reflects the difficulties that the government is having in deciding what it's going to do. But it's reviewing all of its options because threats, and there have been plenty of them the last year, not just by Prime Minister Erdogan and other Turkish officials. There have been threats by France. There have been threats by the United States, all of them relatively hollow. But with the Turks, they can't be hollow. They've got to do something. And they say, we're already doing something with the refugees. There have been these incidents, too. There was one earlier, within the last week, of automatic rifle fire wounding the Syrian refugees, and in one case, at least one Turk who was working in one of these refugee camps, the fire coming from Syria into Turkey. So, I mean, that's a rather flagrant violation. Turks have looked at that. The thing is, the Turks don't want a fragmented mess attracting every type of extremist and terrorist from the Middle East on their border in Syria. That's what happens if there is a collapse of the regime. That's a possibility. They don't want a big Lebanon, in other words, on their border. At the same time, they can't live with the Assads is the way the Assad government's behaving shooting up their own people and driving substantial numbers of their own people into Turkey. What do you do? And they keep coming back to that option that was vetted even a year ago, that we put up the buffer zone, which really is a bounce to a Turkish military incursion, 5, 10, 20 kilometers into Syria that sets up a free, protected Syrian zone. And, of course, the Assad say, probably this is where they've got a legitimate point on this. The Free Syrian Army is going to move into there, and that's the Syrian rebel force. That's because they'd be protected by the Turks. And then the Assads and the Iranians would say the Turks are waging war against the Assads. And in a certain sense, that would be the case. And the Turks know that. That's why they're so conflicted about what they're going to do.
Yeah, the Turks are basically waiting for a blessing from the Saudis, the head of the Arabs, as it were, before they make any military move, because there's still a lot of bad memories. I mean, you know, nobody was born when the Turks ran the Arab world, but, you know, the institutional memory is such that Turkish domination is bad. Now, it was bad. The Turks were not gentle if you got out of line. But at the same time, the Turks, next to the Israelis, are the strongest military power in the region, and for the Arabs, the fact that the Turks are Muslim is good. So in extremis, they could have their Turkish allies do the dirty work, and there would be some condemnation anyway. But if you have the blessing of the senior people in the Arab countries, you know, this could be, you know, plastered over with time. But nobody wants to do that because, again, memories are long in this part of the world. And one thing everybody is still trying to forget is what the Turks did over the course of about 1,000 years.
Well, I think that's a good place to leave it. And I'm looking at this as the long, long Syrian spring. Looks like it may drag out for a lot longer, too.
Yeah, so, it's the Syrian spring under the blood moon. It's right. Not going to be fun.
Yeah. All right, we'll talk to you gentlemen next time.
Take care. Bye.
Bye.